Welcome to Gospel in Life. Today, Tim Keller is teaching on foundational beliefs of Christianity. After you listen, be sure to go online to gospelinlife.com and sign up to receive our email updates to encourage you with gospel-centered resources. When you do, we'll send you a complimentary e-resource entitled Cultural Renewal Through Faithful Work. Subscribe today at gospelinlife.com/work.
After I'm done with the talk that I'm about to give you, we will have a musical interlude, and then we have an open forum. What that means is that once the interlude is over, I stand, or usually I sit right there, and we hope that a lot of you are going to stay for that time. We have open mics, and you can ask any question at all, as long as it has something to do with something I know. Something to do with the subject, something to do with religion, Christianity, faith, and so on. We ask you to stay away from quantum physics and auto repair and ice hockey, three things that I know nothing about. It's frightening for me to realize that 25 years ago, Andrew Lloyd Webber and Tim Rice, who are pretty successful right now, Andrew Lloyd Webber, who's well-known for writing the music for Phantom and Cats. Tim Rice evidently has done pretty well. He wrote a lot of the lyrics for The Lion King. 25 years ago, they wrote Jesus Christ Superstar, the rock opera. And in that rock opera, there's a place in which Jesus Christ confronts Pilate. Now, the rock opera is based on a part of the New Testament, of the book of John, in which Jesus is led in chains before the governor of Judah. And Jesus' tremendous claims about himself, being king of the world, king of the Jews, king of Israel, the people who hated him decided that's a treasonous claim. So they brought him before Pontius Pilate. And they said, this man's guilty of treason. He says he's king instead of Caesar. And so Pilate questions Jesus, and in John 18, it's very dramatic if you see it. In John 18, he comes and says, are you the king of the Jews, he says to Jesus, and Jesus says, is that your conclusion, or did somebody tell you that? Pilate says, am I a Jew? I don't know anything about you. Your own people brought me here. And Jesus says, my kingdom's not of this world. Ah, says Pilate, so you are a king. And Jesus gets up a certain amount of authority and power, and he says, I came into the world to testify to the truth. That's why I came. Pilate's a little bit shaken, but he recovers, and he says, what is truth? And in the rock opera, he says, rather clipped, remember it? He says, what is truth? Is truth unchanging law? We both have truths. Are mine the same as yours? Remember? What is truth? But what is truth? Now, Joy Davidman was a writer. She was a graduate of Hunter College. She was a New Yorker. She actually graduated from Hunter College in 1934, a year before this building was built. Kind of interesting. So I guess she must have been in the one, you know, up on Lexington. And she wrote something about what Pilate said. And she said, what did Pilate mean by his what is truth? It wasn't a really sincere question. He was implying a doctrine fashionable in his time. It's the lie of the skeptic, who rather than face his own sins will even doubt his own reality. Thus he questions that there is even such a thing as truth. We must understand Pilate to understand ourselves. For he represented the very contemporary view that truth is, after all, a relative and subjective affair, an agreed upon convention, a matter of expediency, and that therefore we are justified in doing whatever seems expedient, even as Pilate. Now, Joy Davidman says something pretty cutting. She says, we must understand Pilate to understand ourselves. She says, you can ask the question, what is truth? In a very sincere way. I want to know. She says, Pilate did not ask that question in a sincere way. He asked the question so that he could essentially, it was a rhetorical question, so he could say, well, who knows what is truth? But what is truth? Is truth unchanging law? We both have truth. Are mine the same as yours? And Joy Davidman says, one of the main reasons why we put forth that idea is so that we can do the expedient thing, as Pilate did. Now, the reason we have to deal with this subject is because whenever you have a debate of any sort, or a discussion of any kind about anything, just about, it very often ends like this, especially discussions about religion. They end like this. One person says, ah, but you know, that may be true for you, but it's not true for me. When it comes to these issues, when it comes to the ideas of morality and right and wrong and God and eternity and heaven and hell and all that, we both have truths. Are mine the same as yours? See? And so that's the end of the discussion. There's a problem with that. The problem is you can ask that in a sincere way, and you can ask that in a very insincere way. And somebody says, okay, you're going to have to give me good evidence for the idea that there's moral absolutes. Well, I want to try that tonight, and here's the way I want to go at it. As Joy Davidman said, that's the thesis. We have to understand Pilate to understand ourselves. And I would like to say, I'm hoping I'm going to be gentle. I hope my style will be gentle, because the thesis is kind of aggressive. Okay? And the thesis is this. I stand here as a representative of historic Christianity. I don't know how that happened, but here I am. Historic Christianity says there is such a thing as truth. Moral absolutes, absolute truths, truths about God and eternal things that everybody, every individual, and every culture needs to bow to and submit to. And the way to demonstrate that, the way the Bible demonstrates it, and the way I'm going to try to demonstrate it tonight, is not in a sense to try to prove it, but try to show you that though you may deny it, and I certainly hope there's plenty of you around. By the way, the Bible says, something very reliable, and that is the Gallup poll says 66% of Americans say there is no such thing as absolute truth. So I would hope we don't have a little embattled minority in here, and all of you believe that? No. If you do say, we both have truths, or mine the same as yours, the way to show you that you're wrong is that you use the very thing you deny, that you can't move without smuggling into your life all kinds of realities and stability that you deny intellectually, but practically you live as if there's absolute truth. You don't make a move without using it. The Bible says, and I'm trying to say, you deny that there's absolute truth, but then you use it continually to even move around. You deny it so you can do the expedient thing like Pilate. But in the actual warp and woof of your life, you use it continually and you act as if you must know it. And where would the knowledge come from unless it's there? You can't, as I'm going to try to show you, deny absolute truth without affirming it. So let's do it this way. First of all, let me show you how we deny it. Secondly, why we deny it. And thirdly, how we use it anyway. And that you can't avoid it. And you might as well be consistent, because there's no way, in the end, to deny absolute truth. Well, first of all, let me show you how we deny it. Rather briefly, and if you're in graduate school or college right now, you know what I'm about to tell you is true. If you're like me, and you've been out of it for a while, and you realize that Jesus Christ Superstar was written 25 years ago, and that scares you a bit, if you're like me, some of this might not be, this might be news to you. But currently, the idea that there is no truth, the idea that there are no moral absolutes, the concept has always been with us, and there's always been a strain of intelligentsia who believed it. It's never been embedded in our culture the way it is now, embedded in academia, embedded in and systematized in the thinking of the culture and of the cultural leaders as it is now. The big shift happened, well, some people say it's been happening over since the Romantic poets, but the big shift has happened in this way. Today we've moved, in a sense, from being called what they used to call modern into what's now being called postmodernism. And postmodern society and postmodern thinkers say there's no truth. Let me give you a little quote from somebody. Doesn't matter where it came from, because there's just hundreds of books that talk like this. All truth is only truth so-called. It is socially constructed. It's constructed by the people in power. There are only multiple changeable truths. Just to get you the sense of this, here's a couple of slogans. One of the slogans of postmodernism is, everybody's in drag. Well, you say, wait a minute, I know what a drag queen is. Well, the postmodernist says, listen, everybody's in drag. The clothes you're wearing are uniforms. They don't express who you are, they create who you are. Because there's no essential nature, there's no essential principle, there's no essential you that you have to come into, come under the and submit to. There are only contextual concepts, there are no essential principles. There's no inner essence, there's only surface and images. There's no grand narrative, there's only multiple storylines. There's no reality, there's only virtual reality. Here's a guy named Anderson who wrote a book in 1990, and this is the title. It's a long title. Listen. Reality isn't what it used to be, : theatrical politics, ready-to-wear religion, global myths, primitive chic, and other wonders of the postmodern world. That's the title. And in it, he lays out what's very, very typical now, and it has been typical for the, you might say, the cultural elites and the intelligentsia in the Western world now for at least a couple decades. He says there are objectivists and constructionists. Objectivists believe there is such a thing as objective truth. There's a reality out there that can be known. Constructionists say that you create your own reality. And this is what he says. The constructivists, whose thinking runs close to my own, say that we do not have a God's eye view of non-human reality. We never had, we never will. We live completely in symbolic worlds, social realities that people construct together and yet experience as the object of real world when it's not. Another very important thing, though, to say is, you say, well, this has been around for a while, has it not? Well, let me just show you. It's gotten a little more systematic. It's gotten more virulent, I guess you could say. Even when I was in college, the idea that you believed that you had the truth was considered narrow. Ah, yes, they said, because this is the older postmodernism, older relativism was the existentialists. Sartre, Camus, and they believed that you constructed your reality as an individual. And so they just, you know, they lauded the noble individual, the person who wouldn't conform, who decided what is right for him or her. But you see, today, the understanding is that even the individual doesn't have the power to do that. You know, Camus used to say, in the plague, his idea of an authentic person was somebody who said, yes, the world's absurd. Yes, there's no justice. But I see evil and I'm going to fight evil. I'm going to go down to a never-ending defeat against evil. It's an absurd existence, but then I'm authentic, you see. I've created myself. I've created my identity. The contemporary postmodern person says, how do you know that's evil? How can you fight against evil? Who says that's evil? Where'd you come up with that? And today, postmodernists would say, if you insist that you have a truth that other people have to bow to, you're not just being narrow, it's a power play. And here's the argument. The argument is, anybody who says that you've got the truth is not just narrow, you're oppressive. You are coming to my group and telling my group that I have to bow to your group. Because it's groups, you see, that construct truth. And so anybody who says, this is the truth, well, you're just trying to put your group on top. And therefore, it's absolutely oppressive. There's a guy named Terry Eagleton who put this very well. And he said, I'm going to have to explain something here for a second. Postmodern thinkers don't talk about systems. They don't even talk about truth. They talk about meta-narratives. Because you see, when we talk about as a Christians, we would say we believe there's a system of truth, a system of truth. But the postmodernists say that's silly. All you've got is a narrative. You've got a story. You tell these stories to give your group identity and to make your group feel it's better than other groups. But there are no meta-narratives. There's no narratives that are true for everybody. And the only way we're going to have a non-oppressive society is if we completely get it rid of objective truth. We have to. He puts it this way. This is a quote from Terry Eagleton. Postmodernism signals the death of such meta-narratives whose secretly terroristic function was to ground and legitimate the illusion of a universal history. We are now in the process of awakening from the nightmare of modernity with its manipulative reason and fetish of the totality into the laid-back pluralism of the postmodern. Science and philosophy and religion must totally jettison their grandiose metaphysical claims, and they have to view themselves more modestly as just another set of narratives. And this view says the purpose of scholarship and the purpose of politics and the purpose of literature and the purpose of art and the purpose of religion is not to find truth, how oppressive, but to allow groups to create their own symbols and tell their own stories to empower them and give themselves a sense of identity. But there is nothing that's real for everybody. So there's only one sin, and that's intolerance. But not just intolerance, but specifically the intolerance of insisting that there's a truth over other groups. All such claims are a power play. Now, what effects is that having? If this is true, and one of the good things about postmodernism is the average person on the street for years has been saying what Pilate said so that they can do what they want. Well, what is truth? Is truth unchanging law? We both have truths. Are mine the same as yours? But the good thing about the thinkers of the last 20 years is they're laying these things out and they're making us look at the implications. What if there's no meta-narratives? What if there's no truth? What if there's no reality, but just virtual reality? Well, I'll give you a couple of ways in which you can operate, and the postmodern thinkers tell you. First of all, the most noble and the most honest thing is to embrace it. And listen to this. The Czech novelist Milan Kundera he wrote a novel, and the title of it says it all. We have to embrace the unbearable lightness of being. Do you understand, if there is no truth, that your own being is unbearably light? When I went to school in central Pennsylvania, right on the Susquehanna River, and the year I graduated, the Susquehanna River overflowed its banks because of Hurricane Agnes. And it came right through all those little towns. And I went back to see the places after the water had gone through. And the only things that really stayed put were monuments, heavy things, things that were weighty. Because anything that was light was just whisked away. Well, here's what postmodernism says. Do you believe there's no truth? Do you believe we both have truths? Are mine the same as yours? Then you might as well be honest about it and embrace the unbearable lightness of your being. It's unbearably light. Here's why. There is nothing in your life. There is nothing anywhere. There's no eternal. There's no reality that we all have to bow to. There's nothing that can stand in the flow of time. There is nothing that's going to last. There's nothing about you. There's nothing you believe. Nothing. You're unbearably light. You're whisked away. Do you realize that means that nothing in your life, nothing is real, and therefore nothing matters? Nothing matters. You say, well, it matters whether I love people or whether I kill them. Really? Let me ask you something. Will that make any difference? Yes, of course it'll make a difference. For how long? Don't you realize the flood is here? The river is rising? Don't you realize that there is no truth? If there's no eternal truth, if there's nothing that lasts, if there's nothing that's always here, whether you believe it or not, nothing matters. Nothing sticks. Nothing is weighty enough. There's nothing of matter. See? Everything's going. Nothing makes a difference. Everything is on its way out. The unbearable lightness of being. Accept it. Well, now that's the most noble thing to do. Now here's another approach to relativism, and that is the Johnny... I'm showing my age. Oh my gosh, I had to look at it. Johnny Rotten and the Sex Pistols. Can you believe it? I'm sorry. I've just lost credibility with an awful lot of you. I mean, credibility is everything. Truth is nothing. Style is everything. You know, surface image... And so I blew it. I know I did. It's a horrible thing. But you know what? You don't need Dostoevsky anymore when you've got Johnny Rotten and the Sex Pistols, because one of his lyrics goes this way. If nothing true, everything possible. Dostoevsky said, if God is dead, everything is permitted. And of course, Johnny Rotten probably has not read Dostoevsky, I don't think, unless it's, you know, I don't know, on Laserdisc. And he says, if nothing true, everything possible. So what the heck? Do it. Do it. Who's to say? Who's to say what's wrong? But what is truth? Is truth unchanging? Is truth got matter? Is truth something that's always there? No. We both have truths. Are mine the same as yours? Actually, the most terrifying thing, the most noble is to embrace the unbearable lightness of being. The most fun is just to do what Johnny Rotten and the Sex Pistols do. The most terrible is to become a terrorist. Construct a meta-narrative, even though you know that anything you say is not true, and just exert power, because that's all that's left. But, now, that's how we deny it. We deny it today. And there's got to be plenty of people in the room, because the Gallup poll said so, who deny it as well. You don't like to embrace the unbearable lightness of your being. I'm suggesting that you better, if you want to be consistent. But you know what you say? Now see, if you're a good postmodernist, you say, consistency, that's just you. You know, that's Eurocentric. That's sort of a white male thing to talk about. Consistency, who cares? How dare you even tell me about consistency? Of course it's inconsistent, that's all right. You see, you've constructed that as your reality, but in my reality, consistency doesn't matter. I don't care. I don't care. So, you know, it looks like you've beaten me so far. The second question, though, is why do people deny truth like this? That's how we're doing, but why? And the answer is an old one. In Romans chapter 1, St. Paul, the apostle, one of the founders of Christianity, certainly the Gentile version of Christianity, wrote a letter to the church who was at Rome, and in that first chapter he says this: since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, his eternal power and divine nature are clearly seen, so human beings are without excuse. So God is angry with them who hold down the truth in unrighteousness. Now the word hold down the truth is extremely interesting, and probably the best translation of the Greek here is repress. Now, Paul did a wonderful little judo trick years and years before Freud. Because Freud, and actually an awful lot of the early 20th century, wrote off religion. They had to explain why people were so religious, and here's what they said. In Toten and Taboo, Freud said this, the future of an illusion. Here's what he said. You need to believe. That's why you're religious. You have a psychological need. And the explanation of Freud and an awful lot of the people in the early part of the 20th century, you don't hear much about it now, and I'll show you why. They said the reason that people are religious is they need it. Primitive human beings were frightened by the world. It was so difficult to understand, and it seemed to be overwhelming, and the only way they could deal with it was to believe that there was some kind of personality behind it that they could talk with. And therefore, there's a deep psychological need to be religious. It's wish fulfillment, see? It's wish fulfillment. But, said Freud and all the others, as science makes the world less and less frightening, as we come to see more and more what makes the world tick, the need for religion will fall away. Paul, however, comes around and says, Yes, he says, of course, there are some psychological reasons why a person might be prone to want to believe in God, but there's far more profound psychological reasons why someone would want to repress the idea of truth. He says, there's far more of a psychological desire to repress the truth than to accept it. Why? Because, as we said earlier, reality bites. The Christian idea of truth, not just the Christian, the Muslim idea, the Jewish, I mean, in other words, the old idea of truth is not that things are true because they work, but they work because they're true. Truth is that which recognizes a reality that's there, whether you believe it or not, that you bump your head against. Reality bites. It's resistant material. It means if you don't submit to it, to say, well, you believe this about God, I believe this about God. We both have truths. Now, that's a new idea of truth. The old idea of truth is there may be a God, there may not be a God. One or the other is true. And you better find out which one it is, because either way, if you choose the wrong one, it's like driving with your eyes closed. You don't drive with your eyes closed and say, well, you know, I'm going to turn right. I'm going to construct reality. No, reality will deconstruct you at that point. You see, the whole idea, truth in the old idea, is truth takes you and constructs you. And if you don't submit to it, it deconstructs you. The new idea is that you deconstruct truth and make it what you want to be. So Paul says, which of those seems more, how do I put it, he says, which of those seems more cozy? Which of those seems more comfortable? Which would you rather believe? You have a deep psychological need to repress the very idea of truth. Now who's right?
For hundreds of years, the church has used catechisms to teach foundational biblical doctrines in order to strengthen Christians in their faith and equip them to share the gospel with the world. The New City Catechism devotional, God's Truth for Our Hearts and Minds, is a compilation of gospel doctrine that summarizes important Christian beliefs through 52 questions and answers each with a Bible verse, written commentary, and prayer. This resource is our thank you for your gift to help Gospel and Life share Christ's love with more people. So request your copy of the New City Catechism devotional when you give today at gospelandlife.com/give. That's gospelandlife.com/give. Now, here's Tim Keller with the remainder of today's teaching.
Freud or Paul, every year there's less and less evidence that Freud was right. I'll never forget a conversation I had with a scientist from mainland China, who actually I got it mixed up. He's from mainland China, but he was living on the mainline of Philadelphia when I met him. So he's the mainland guy on the mainline. He became a Christian through the West Philadelphia Chinese Bible study. And here's one of the reasons why he became a Christian. He said to me, we were told, because this is the Marxist, Freudian, Darwinian understanding of religion, we were told that religion was wish fulfillment. People psychologically needed it, but the more technologically advanced society would get, the less need there would be. But I got to America and I saw the most technologically advanced society in the world was also the most religious. So I began to ask why, and I began to inspect, and I began to look for truth, and I found it. Every year that goes by, it gets harder and harder to believe what Freud is saying, but every year that goes by, you have more and more evidence that Paul's right. Listen, you won't understand Pilate yourself until you understand Pilate. Aldous Huxley wrote this in Ways and Means, and this is an amazing statement. Thank you for your honesty. He embraced the unbearable lightness of being. He says, quote, most ignorance is vincible ignorance. We don't know because we don't want to know. Those of us who detect no meaning in the world generally do so because, for one reason or another, it suits us. Now let me go along a little further. See, those of us who detect no meaning in the world generally do so because, now he's not saying everybody, he's not saying that nobody can ever sincerely doubt, but he's saying that's not the way I understand it, that's not the way I work, that's not the way most of the people I know who doubted the existence of truth worked. He says, those who detect no meaning in the world generally do so for one reason or another, it suits them. For myself and for most of my contemporaries, the philosophy of meaninglessness was essentially an instrument of liberation. We desired liberation from a certain system of morality because it interfered with our sexual freedom. There was one admirably simple way of confuting that system and at the same time justifying ourselves in our political and erotic revolt. We could deny the world had any meaning whatsoever, and we did. Don't you see? Look, when you read Caesar's Gallic Wars and you say, is it true? You can be objective. I mean, because whether it's true or not doesn't make any impact on you. But when you read the Bible and say, is it true? Think about it. If it's true, it changes everything. Who in the world can imagine that they're objective at that point? Who in the world can say, I don't have deep psychological prejudices against this being true? Who can say that? Why, for example, what if a woman was a judge and she was found the case came before her, and if the case went this way, she would be financially independent. But if the case was found this way, she would be in a financial bind. Would she even be allowed to try that case? Would she be allowed to sit in judgment on that case? No way. Why? She could say, well, I can be objective, and everybody would say, sure. How in the world can you be objective? You'll want to repress the truth because the truth hurts. The truth bites. Therefore, Paul says, if you believe that there is no truth, you better have checked and double-checked and triple-checked your motives. You better have looked at Christianity top to bottom, inside out, read the Bible through once at least, done everything you can, even when you're prejudiced and even when you're skeptical, to be skeptical of your skepticism. Because what if that woman, what if that judge did for some reason have to sit on that case? Wouldn't she do that if she had any integrity at all? If any had any integrity, she'd have an awful lot of trouble even finding in the direction that would suit her. And so should you. That's why we deny the truth. By and large, you will not understand yourself until you understand Pilate. Okay, my last point. This is that we deny and why we deny. But here's the case that goes a little deeper of all. Even though you may deny the truth for the same reasons that Aldous Huxley said. He said, I wanted to be liberated. I wanted to sleep with who the heck I wanted to sleep with. And I was in philosophy class. I figured a way. Now, Aldous Huxley, for him to say that, is just, he's looking at himself. I'm not saying that everybody who denies truth is like Aldous Huxley. I'm saying, because it would be so easy, you had better be mighty skeptical. But that's not my only case. Here's the last point. Paul says, we hold down the truth in unrighteousness. That doesn't mean we don't know that there's truth, and we don't know that there's absolute values, and we don't know there's a God. That's not what it means. He didn't say we don't know it. He says we know it. We don't admit to ourselves that we know it. But it's still there, and it controls us. How does it control us? If you became, what if you were a championship tennis player, championship, and you got amnesia? You couldn't remember who you were. You couldn't remember that you were a tennis player. But what if we got you out there on the court, even as an amnesiac, and the ball came at you and you went, and you said, how did you ever learn to do that? Well, there's only two or three people in the world that can do that. And you would sit there and say, I know it, so I must have learned it. I wouldn't be operating like this unless I knew it. But I don't know where I got to know it. You see, it's one thing to not admit you know something. It's another thing to find out whether you really do or not. And my friends, everybody knows that there's moral truth. Let me give you a couple of examples. First of all, there's moral rage. Just today, in New York Times Book Review, there was a lady who was reviewing the latest diary of Anne Frank. You see it's on the front page of the New York Times Book Review, a great review, and it's the fullest edition of Anne Frank's diary. The little girl, actually I guess she was 15 when she was finally killed, but she was in hiding in Amsterdam, she and her family, because she was Jewish, but they were found out. And even though her diary is a wonderful, wonderful piece of literature, she was snuffed out in the ovens of Bergen-Belsen. And the reviewer at one point says this: it is unthinkable and disorienting to know that this life was crushed. It is unthinkable and disorienting to know that this life was crushed. All that remains is this diary, evidence of her ferocious appetite for life. It gnaws at us still. Now, look at this. It's unthinkable. It's disorienting. She's upset. Now, I don't know who the reviewer is and what her beliefs are, but I'll just say this. Anybody will feel that way. But if there's no such thing as moral truth, there is no basis for moral rage. Now, I'm not just doing an intellectual thing on you here. Look, over the years, I've done this again and again to people. People say there is no truth. And I'll say, well, what if I decide I'm going to hit you real hard in the mouth? When that happens, I'm sure we'll have to deal with that after I've done it. But I want you to know that there's only one thing that you don't have a right to do in response. You can hit me back. You can kill me. You can do all sorts of things. But you mustn't say that I'm wrong, that I did something wrong. Because you see, wrong to say that is you believe there's some kind of moral standard outside of us that I'm accountable to. That can't be on the basis of what you said. You may not like what I'm doing, but you certainly can't call me wrong. Now, people very often don't like that. I found this out over 20 years of talking to people. You know why? They say, well, maybe I don't know why. I don't understand these things, but I know that some things are always wrong. What is that? That's the tennis player coming out in you. You can say, I know it, but how do you know it? You don't have any basis for it, but let me just show you. Let me go a little deeper. Moral indignation. This lady is not experiencing just moral indignation. She is experiencing moral rage. And I think any human being will when you see this sort of thing. But let me ask you, those of you who say, but what is truth? On what basis do you get this moral rage? Look carefully at yourself. When you are morally outraged, when you say, these things are wrong, you may say intellectually, well, I've decided that human life is valuable. You got to realize that what happened here is just nature. Nature is red in tooth and claw. This is the way it is. The Nazis were stronger than the Jews at that point. Well, look out in nature. This is the way it happens. How can you call it wrong? This is just the way it is. You can say, well, I have constructed a truth that says that human life is more valuable than the rock. I know I don't have any basis on that, but I've decided that. Oh, no, you didn't. Oh, no, you didn't. When moral rage hits you, you haven't decided, you haven't constructed your truth. Your truth is possessing you. You know the truth, and it's got you. Don't you see? The contemporary idea of truth is that you construct truth. The old-fashioned idea of truth is that truth constructs you, and you're in the grip of it. It possesses you. It's got you. You don't have any basis for what you're doing. No basis at all. And even if you say, yes, I do, I've constructed it myself, you're not acting consistently with even that. It's got you. Because truth, real truth, possesses you. You don't possess it. Let me give you another example. Art. You know, I'm afraid the people who are artists, they tend to live downtown. The people who are business tend to live uptown. You know, so the further down you get, it's more artists per square mile or something. And the further downtown you get, the more you find that people are going to say, there is no truth. And yet. J.R.R. Tolkien, when he was writing The Lord of the Rings, when he was in the middle of his writing of it in World War II, was extremely upset with the fact that he had this great idea in his heart. He had this view, he had this beautiful story he was trying to get out, and it was taking forever, and he was afraid it would never see the light of day. One morning he got up, and he had the idea of a short story, and he wrote the short story. And when he was done with that short story, he had exorcised his demon. And he went on. And here's what the story was about. It was about a guy named Niggle. And Niggle was an artist, and nobody appreciated him. And he spent all his day on this huge canvas in his house because he had a picture in his mind of a beautiful tree, a gorgeous tree. But he could never do very well at it. In fact, as far as he ever got, all he was ever able to do was get one leaf painted. But he had this picture, he had this picture. Eventually he died. And he lived a very frustrating life. And they put him on a train to heaven, in the story anyway. And he's going, and when he gets into the environment of heaven, even though he's not to his final destination, he looks off to the right and he says, oh my gosh, stop the train. He gets off the train. He runs over. And there it is. His tree. The tree. And he lifts his hands up and he says, it's a gift. And he suddenly realized, his whole life was healed. He suddenly realized that the tree that he was trying so hard to paint was a vision of a tree in reality, and that everybody would someday see it. That any artistic impulse, Tolkien was saying, any artistic impulse is really just a way of the artist getting in touch with something that's really there. And you never get it out, but the only way you can be comforted is to know that there's a truth behind what you're doing. Why is it that artists are usually so unhappy with what they've put up there? If it's just socially constructed, if they just constructed it, how could they be unhappy with it? By what standard are they unhappy with it? But they know in their heart there's a truth that they're trying to get out. There's no way for people to even deny that there's objective truth when they do it. When a person says, you mustn't say there's objective truth, you're oppressing me. What are you doing? You're telling me you can only be tolerant if we don't believe in any such thing as truth. Well, I say to you, if there's no such thing as truth, then tolerance is relative too. So how dare you tell me that tolerance is the one meta-narrative? As soon as you say you mustn't impose your views on other people, you're imposing your view on me at that moment. You're saying I have a different view of reality than you, and you need to conform to me. You see, you can say over and over and over and over again, I don't know a word of English. I don't know a word of English. I don't know a word of English. You can go on and on and on, but the more you say it, the more you deny. You can't say that without denying it by saying it. You affirm what you deny. You deny what you affirm. That's the reason why G.K. Chesterton said there's only one kind of thought that stops thought, and that's the only thought that should be stopped. And that is to say, there's no such thing as truth. Now, my dear friends, when it comes right down to it, a lot of people say, and I'm going to finish with this here, a lot of people say, okay, you've shown me that there's probably truth, but you're telling me that we all kind of know what's good and right, and so the question is, can't I be a Christian? Can I be a Christian? Can I not be a Christian? My wife told me I was going to say this wrong in the car today. Can't I not be a Christian and still be a good person? Can't I be a good person and not be a Christian? Why do I have to be a Christian to be a good person? I don't have to go into all this and believe in the Bible and angels and demons and heaven and hell. I can still be a good person. You just told me I can. Okay? So I can still be a good person. C.S. Lewis, in his very famous essay, Man or Rabbit, answers the question this way. He says, the question before each of us tonight is not, can someone lead a good life without Christianity? The question is, can I? And we all know that there have been good men who were not Christians, men like Socrates and Confucius who never heard of it. But the person who asked me, can't I lead a good life without believing in Christianity, is clearly not in the same position. If having heard of it and having seriously considered it, you have decided that it was untrue Christianity, then you would not be asking that question at all. But the one who asked this question has usually heard of Christianity and is by no means certain that it may not be true. He's really saying, do I really have to bother with it? Do I really have to submit to it? Mayn't I just evade the issue? Can't I just let sleeping dogs lie? Can't I get on with just being good? Isn't that the important thing? Aren't good intentions enough to keep me safe and blameless without knocking at that dreadful door and making sure there is or isn't somebody inside? A person who speaks this way is shirking. He's deliberately trying not to know whether Christianity is true or false, because he foresees endless trouble if it should turn out to be true. He's like the man who deliberately forgets to look at the notice board because if he did, he might find his name down on some unpleasant duty. He's like the man who won't look at his bank account because he's afraid of what he might find there. He's like the man who will never go to the doctor when he feels a mysterious pain because he's afraid of what the doctor may tell him. The person who believes remains an unbeliever for such reasons. Who says, I don't want to have to deal with it. Can't I just be a good person? The person who remains an unbeliever for such reasons is not in a state of honest error. You're in a state of dishonest error, and that dishonesty will spread through all your thoughts and actions. A certain shiftiness, a vague worry in the background, a blunting of this whole mental edge will result. You've lost your intellectual virginity. To evade the Son of Man, to look the other way, to pretend you haven't noticed, to become suddenly absorbed in something on the other side of the street, to leave the receiver off the telephone hook because it might be he who was ringing up, to leave unopened certain letters in a strange handwriting because they might be from him, that's a different matter. You may not be certain yet whether you ought to be a Christian, but you do know you ought not to be an ostrich hiding its head in the sand. Well, somebody says, but I want to know, will Christianity make me happy? Do you really think I'd be better if I became a Christian, you say? Would I be a better person? Would I be a happier person? Well, says C.S. Lewis, if you must have an answer, my answer is yes, but I sure don't like giving an answer at this stage. Don't you see? There's a door there, behind which, according to some people, the secret of the universe is waiting for you. Now, either it's true or it isn't. Faced with such an issue, can you really remain wholly absorbed in your own blessed moral development? All right, let me say it. Christianity will do you good, but a great deal more good than you ever wanted or expected. The first bit of good it will do you is to hammer into your head the fact that you have hitherto thought you were good, but you're not. And all that you thought about leading a decent life and being kind isn't quite the magnificent and important affair you supposed. In other words, the first thing you will learn if you actually seek Christianity out is that you can't be good on your own moral efforts. Don't you see? The people who keep on asking if they can't lead a decent life without Christ don't know what life is about. If they did, they would know that a decent life is mere machinery compared with the thing we are really made for. Oh, morality is indispensable, but the divine life, which gives itself to us and which transforms us, intends for us something in which morality will someday be swallowed up. We are to be remade. We're not becoming a better person through Christianity. We're becoming a whole new kind of being. It's as if we were rabbits. Conscientious, ethical, worried little rabbits. But if you come to Christ, you will bleed and squeal as the handfuls of fur come out, and then surprisingly we shall find underneath something we never imagined. A son of God, a daughter of God, strong, radiant, wise, beautiful, and drenched in joy. When that which is perfect is come, then that which is in part shall be done away. The idea of reaching a good life without Christ is based on a double error. First, we can't do it. Secondly, in setting up a good life as our final goal, you've missed the very point of your existence. Morality is a mountain which we cannot climb by our own efforts, and if we could, we would only perish in the ice and unbreathable air of the summit, lacking those wings with which the rest of the journey has to be accomplished. For it's from there that the real ascent begins. The ropes and the axes are done away, and the rest is a matter of flying. When a person says, but can I be good and not be a Christian? You don't realize what Christianity is about, what life is about. It's about getting the divine life into you. Not just a truth you know out here, but a truth that comes in, that you eat, that transforms you. Truth that becomes part of you. That's the reason why Jesus said, not I show you the truth, but I am the way, the truth, the life. If you're of the truth, he said to Pilate, you'll be on my side. Let's pray. Father, I pray that these words are true. I'm sure not all of them are. Only your words are true completely. But if anything I've said here tonight is true, I pray that it would sink into all of our hearts and really make us not little rabbits, but sons and daughters of God. We pray this in Jesus' name. Amen.
Thanks for listening today. Be sure to sign up for email updates and get the free resource, Cultural Renewal Through Faithful Work. Just visit gospelandlife.com/work. Thanks again for listening to Gospel and Life. This month's messages were recorded in 1995 and 2015. The sermons and talks you hear on the Gospel and Life podcast were preached from 1989 to 2017 while Dr. Keller was senior pastor at Redeemer Presbyterian Church.